Today at Reader's Corner, Gregory Burns, author of What It's Like to Be a Dog and Other Adventures in Animal Neuroscience. I'm Bob Custra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Over thousands of years, dogs have earned the title of man's best friend. Yet even as their companionship brings us personal joy and satisfaction, we may wonder what's going on inside their heads. Do they adore us as much as we adore them? Or do they just see us as reliable dispensers of food? In his new book, What It's Like to Be a Dog and Other Adventures in Animal Neuroscience, best-selling author Gregory Burns describes scientific breakthroughs that show that the brains of dogs and other animals are remarkably similar to those of humans. Dr. Burns is a neuroscientist at Emory University in Atlanta. He and his research team have successfully taught dogs to sit completely still and unrestrained in MRI scanners. By scanning the dog's brain activity when it responds to simple tests, the researchers are able to gain new insights into how dogs think and feel. In his new book, Dr. Burns describes his work with dogs as well as other studies focused on the thought processes of animals such as dolphins and sea lions. This growing body of research shows that we share characteristics with animals that for centuries were considered solely human, including the ability to dance, feel regret, and find pleasure in a familiar face. Gregory Burns is the distinguished professor of neuroeconomics at Emory University and a professor in the psychology department. He is the author of several books, including the bestseller How Dogs Love Us. He joins us today by phone from Emory University. Gregory Burns, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Hey, great to be here.
So let's start off with a question that comes from your first book or an earlier book, How Dogs Love Us. Somewhere in that book, you posed the question that you thought your readers would be asking when they saw the title of the book or learned more about your research. And these are your words, I believe. Shouldn't we be using these expensive MRI machines to improve human health? Is this not just a colossal waste of money? Now, obviously, you have an answer for that. I've read it. I get it. But why don't you share it with our listeners?
Sure. I think there's a couple of answers to that. The first is that this is not a zero-sum game in the sense that resources that we use to study how dogs' brains function is necessarily taking resources away from understanding human health. And the reason I say that is because the results that we're discovering about how dogs' brains function have implications for how our own brains function. So when we study how dogs' brains respond to, say, you know, the scent of a familiar person or the sight of a familiar person, and we see that it's reacting in ways that we think look very similar to how humans respond in those situations, well, it's just another piece of the puzzle to understand the human condition. So in many ways, we are studying and understanding and helping humans just by looking at dogs. And then the other kind of answer to this is the fact that dogs are hugely important to a lot of people. You know, there's probably a dog for every 10 people in the world. That's an enormous number. And so understanding these creatures that we share our lives with does have direct benefits for us.
Well, and I also think I read that obviously you connect your research to the fact that we train service dogs and we can learn more about how we train them and how we can get better at training them, I would assume.
That's right. And so that's more of an applied application, I would say. So, you know, the role of dogs has changed quite a bit over the years. And so if you went back 100 years, dogs would be doing very different things than they do now. And so one of the evolving roles of dogs is to act as assistance animals, service animals. I mean, largely they're companions. And so understanding this evolution from, say, you know, a hunting dog or a shepherd dog to these other roles and trying to identify characteristics in their brains and their minds that better suit them to life in a modern society, I think is very applicable and helps humans as well.
A few years ago, there were media reports, and boy, I remember reading this and was just so devastated. It was about a book on dog research where the author concluded that dogs are using us, they're manipulating us to get food, they have no ability to care about us nor love us, and therefore they may not be man's best friend. I might be adding that, but I think that was actually in the report as well. So for us dog lovers out there, what can we take away from your book and your research on dogs as of 2017?
Yeah. So, I mean, my approach, as you pointed out, is to train dogs to go into an MRI machine and see how their brains function under controlled circumstances. And by looking at particular parts of the brain that we know function, say, in motivation and reward and interest, we can use that as a way to essentially decode what dogs are thinking because of the fact that they can't speak to us. And so I think a lot of these past statements that, you know, dogs may be using us or, you know, they're really in it just for the food, confuse the issue because you can't really know what a dog is thinking by just looking at them from the outside. And so our results suggest that dogs are not just getting food out of this relationship. And the reason we know this is because when the dogs are in the scanner and their owners are there praising them and there's no food involved, I mean, they're getting the same reward response in their brain as a human would to being praised. And so it looks very similar.
So let's understand better just how you get a dog to go into an MRI. It's tough enough to get a human to go into an MRI scan. So help us explain that, and especially, of course, the focus on whether you have to force the dog in there or not.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, when I started this project, which was now 6 years ago, it started as just kind of a crazy side project, just with the crazy idea of, could I train my dog to go in an MRI to see what she's thinking and use the same tools that we use in humans? And the real issue is that, you know, the things that people find uncomfortable about MRIs are not the same things that dogs necessarily find uncomfortable. So dogs, for example, don't get claustrophobic. They're not worried about that. And they don't really even know what the MRI is. So they have no reason to kind of think that it's, you know, something scary. And so the approach that we took was to treat the dogs as voluntary participants in the project. So we decided that we would not force any dog to do this. We would not restrain them. We wouldn't use any sedation or anesthesia. We would just teach them how to do it the same way you would teach a dog to do any trick, really. And a lot of it is just making a game out of the whole process. And so we built simulators of the MRI. We built mock-ups of the little head coil that they have to put their head in. We build chin rest, and then we practice outside the scanner at a training facility. And the idea is just to make it a game. We use positive reinforcement. It's fun. We add in the noise at a certain point, and we do it at low volume initially. And again, the idea is to make it a signal that this is fun. So when the dogs hear the scanner running, they get excited. It's like, oh boy, we get to play this game. And really, with the proper selection of participants, so we hold tryouts to see if a dog's going to like doing this, it turns out not to be as difficult as you might think. And most people train their dogs in about, I'd say, 2 to 4 months of coming to our MRI practice every Sunday and practicing at home, and then they're ready to go.
So what's the flunk-out rate? Who just is like, oh, man, this isn't working. This dog has to go back home.
It's less than it used to be. So, you know, we've now trained over 90 dogs. And so initially our kind of washout rate was probably about 30 to 40% would not complete the training process. And that was kind of a combination of perhaps owner enthusiasm or lack of enthusiasm for it, coupled with a dog's not really liking it in the end. And so we refined our tryout process to better identify the dogs that probably weren't going to enjoy doing it. And so, you know, when we have tryouts, we simulate certain parts of the process. And if a dog shows kind of any signs of trepidation or, you know, anxiety, we politely tell the owner that this is probably not going to be that much fun for you and your dog and, you know, let them go at that point. So since we did that, our success rate is now probably about 80%. On dogs who volunteer.
I think I read where there were some scientists who were critical of your sample size, but it sounds like if you're up to 90, you're certainly dealing with that.
Yeah, when we started, it was literally just two dogs doing an experiment, and then it kind of steadily grew. We started putting word of mouth out that we're looking for volunteers, and then we were up to about 10, and then pretty soon that grew to about 20. And it's kind of a rotating cast of characters as kind of people move, you know, in and out of Atlanta. You know, we've now been doing this for so long that actually some of the dogs have passed away. And then we started a side project in California, actually. And that was the project we did with the service dogs with Canine Companions for Independence.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Gregory Burns, a neuroscientist and author of What It's Like to Be a Dog and Other Adventures in Neuroscience. So tell us what you discovered about animal brains when you began scanning them in terms of how they related to human brain scans.
So I've always been fascinated kind of with the two sides of the coin, you know, how similar and are brains to animal brains to human brains, and then where are the differences. So most of the things that we focused on, I would say, are on similarities. So I mentioned kind of how dogs respond to praise. We found that the same structure that would respond to reward in humans is also the structure in the dog's brain that responds to praise as well as the scent of a familiar human. We've also identified that the dogs have a specialized part of their brain for processing faces, both human and dog faces. And this parallels a structure in human brains that also processes faces. It even has a special name called the face area. Some of it, I think, is just kind of the socialization process that dogs have by living with us, and they become accustomed to it. But I think a big part of it is also that they're wired that way, just genetically. That's what may differentiate them from wolves. And so it's fascinating that we see these, what we call homologous or analogous structure in a dog brain to a human brain.
So for years, scientists pretty much dismissed the idea that we could ever understand what it was like to be other, to be inside the brain of an animal. I guess there was some initial research on bats by a couple of scientists who challenged that idea.
Right. It was actually a philosopher, Thomas Nagel, who wrote a famous essay called What Is It Like to Be a Bat? And what he was saying was he was reacting to a couple of things, and this was now 40 years ago. In part, it was a reaction to this idea that by studying the brain with neuroscience that we could somehow reduce these ineffable subjective qualities of you know, subjective experience to neural firings. And so a lot of the reaction was to that people resisted the idea that everything in our subjective experience is somehow biologically and physically in our brains. Now, I would say at the time that was probably true, that neuroscience was not at a stage where it could really link neural activity to these subjective experiences. But that was 40 years ago, and there have been a lot of advances in the technology. The one in particular that I find most convincing is in the area of what we would call brain decoding. And this has been done quite successfully in humans where, for example, you can have a person in the scanner and you'd be scanning their brains continuously while they're watching a movie. And then going back afterwards using very sophisticated computer algorithms, you can actually extract from their brain activity the images that they were seeing at the time. And you can actually have a computer reconstruct that. And so this is kind of a pretty damning piece of evidence that says, yeah, we can actually start to decode what people are seeing and possibly feeling and thinking. So all I've done is just take that into another animal and I'll start applying it to dogs. And I think we will be able to know what it's like to be a dog pretty soon.
So in the meantime, in your book, you also cover some correlations between sea lions and human brains. Tell us about that.
That's right. So when I started studying dogs, it was kind of a natural extension to start wondering about other animals out there. Now, dogs are the only ones that will willingly and cooperatively go in the scanner. So we began studying the brains of other animals, but these are brains that came to us for whatever reason. The animal, you know, either died or had to be euthanized from some rehab center. And so we started looking at the structure of these brains, again, using kind of new imaging technologies to understand both similarities and differences across species. So it's amazing that if you look at the vast field of neuroscience, almost all of the work that's been done in neuroscience is concentrated in just a handful of species. Humans, of course, monkeys, a little bit in some other apes, and then rats and mice. And that constitutes kind of the vast bulk of neuroscience knowledge. And yet there's 5,000 other mammals out there on the planet. And so what I'm interested in is building up what we call a brain arc, a digital brain arc, and try to fill in the evolutionary tree of brains and try to understand how, you know, the brain of a sea lion makes that a sea lion and the brain of a tiger makes it a tiger. We don't know the answers to these questions. And so by studying the structure of them and how different parts of the brain are connected to each other, we hope to figure this out.
And you've also scanned several dolphin brains and made some surprising discoveries.
That's right. So one of our early forays into this area was looking at some dolphin brains. And these brains had been essentially preserved in buckets of formaldehyde for a decade. The dolphins had stranded themselves, I think, in North Carolina now 10 or 15 years ago. And so we took these brains and tried to understand their auditory pathways. So there's a fair amount of debate about, you know, what dolphins do with sonar. So we know that they use it. The big question is, do they construct some kind of mental image out of it, or is it an auditory image, if that makes any sense? And what we found was that their auditory system is actually wired in many ways just like ours. It has some added pieces to it, but it's not fundamentally different. And so when we get back to the question, what is it like to be, you know, a dog or a dolphin? The answer that keeps coming back, at least to me, is that it's very similar to being a human, but without words to describe it.
Tell us about the hedgehog block experiment and what you discovered there.
This is an experiment that we were doing with the dogs to try to understand what dogs get from human language. Do they understand, for example, when we say ball, do they have a mental image in their head of this ball thing, or is it something entirely different? So this is probably the most difficult experiment that we did. So what we did was we had the dog owners train their dogs on the names of two arbitrary objects. So the ones that I used for Callie, my dog, was a little toy in the shape of a hedgehog and then just a block of foam. And then over months, I would try to teach her the names of these two objects by, you know, having her go to the object in a different room. And it was extremely difficult, much more difficult than we ever anticipated. Most of the dogs got to a level of proficiency after many months, and then what we did was we scanned them while the owners were speaking these words to the dogs. And what we wanted to know is, do the dogs have a mental image associated with these words? So do they conjure up the object in their mind? And the answer seems to be probably not. It seems that they're extracting meaning out of these words in a way that's very different than humans do it. It seems to be much lower level. It may even be at the level of just associating sounds with certain things. But at this point, it doesn't appear that words have meaning to the dogs, at least in the way that humans do.
Very interesting. You know, we had Terry Williams on our show for the Odyssey of KP2, and recently we were talking with her, and she was telling us about some research involving dolphins where they could only get dolphins to remember 2 to 3 tasks at a time. And I'm just wondering how you think a dog would be able to handle that versus what difficulties they were having dealing with a dolphin in that case.
Well, as you were saying that, I was saying it sounds like most humans to me.
Yeah, right.
I don't think dogs would do any better. And I really don't think humans do that much better on those sorts of things.
Right, exactly. I'm Bob Kustra, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Gregory Burns about his book, What It's Like to Be a Dog, which looks at how scientific breakthroughs are changing our understanding of how animals think and feel. So I'd like to spend the rest of this brief discussion talking about the implications of your research, and not just your research, but the science that's on its way today. To taking us into an era of what one gentleman, I believe, calls the era of intelligent design, and that would be Yuval Harari, who you actually mentioned in your book. He's the author of Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow. And I'd like to just talk with you a little bit about that. First of all, let's just talk about self-awareness, sentience, I guess, as you scientists call it. Do you think animals are self-aware of their own suffering?
Well, that's a difficult question. And so I think it needs to be unpacked a little bit. So the way I would answer this is that awareness or sentience, so sentience is being aware of your environment and the sensations that are coming in to your body. I would say that sentience is a continuum. And the reason I say that is because all you have to do is kind of look at yourself on a 24-hour basis. When you're asleep, you're hardly conscious and hardly sentient. You are not aware of pretty much anything going on in the environment or even your bodily sensations. So we know that sentience, consciousness, awareness can fluctuate. So similarly, it's reasonable to assume that across the animal kingdom, there are different capacities for sentience and consciousness. Certainly, all animals with a cortex, which would include all mammals, have the ability to be aware of the sensations coming in and in their environmental surroundings. Now, if you wanted to extend that to kind of a higher level of awareness or consciousness, you can extend it to the awareness, for example, that other people and other beings are also sentient. So scientists call that theory of mind. People have theory of mind. We know that another person has a mind and that they're thinking, and we can think about them thinking. It's very unclear whether any other animal has that ability, but that's not really a big deal. If we're talking about sentience and how we treat animals, it seems very clear at this point that just having the cortex is probably sufficient to be aware enough that if you are in pain, yeah, you better believe it. You're suffering, and you know you're suffering.
Well, that obviously has some implications down the road, and by down the road, I mean, who knows, maybe it's the next century for all I know. But you did cite some indicators. I think it was the Animal Welfare Council in England made a statement, and there's USDA data on animals in research. The rat, for example, I believe you mentioned, while used often in experimental research, may not be that far away from the dog in terms of brain activity.
That's right. I mean, even though it's one of the most commonly used animals in research, I mean, it's so common it's not even tracked by the government because there are millions of them used. But the irony of it is that the reason that they're being used is as a model of some human biological system. And in many cases, that is a neurobiological or brain system. So my view is you can't have it both ways. You know, if you're studying animals as a model of humans, then you also have to acknowledge that they're probably experiencing things in ways that are similar to humans.
What role does the Animal Welfare Act play in this debate, if that's what it is?
The Animal Welfare Act doesn't play a whole lot of role in this debate. In fact, it doesn't even include rats and mice as an animal that is under its jurisdiction. The Animal Welfare Act is a set of rules and regulations that govern how research is done on animals and sets minimal standards for pain and suffering. So it doesn't prohibit suffering. It just means that you as an experimenter in an institution have to do your best efforts to minimize it and control pain in a way that is acceptable. So I think that has nothing to do with this question.
Where do you think this is going to go? I mean, I see reports regularly of pigs who are pets and
right.
who are declared to be very smart animals. I don't want to take on the pork producers here, but is the day going to come when all of a sudden we realize that animals that we've eaten, and I believe you, as a matter of fact, turned into a vegetarian somewhere along the lines of your research. Help us with that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't call myself a vegan or a vegetarian because I think that's disingenuous. The best I can say is that I do my best to minimize eating animals. And if and when I do, I'm thoughtful and conscious about it. The problem, I would say, with being vegetarian or vegan is that's almost a religious statement. It's a black and white statement. And as soon as you fall off the wagon, it's like, no, I guess you're not. But anyway, that's not the question. The answer to the question is that it is already changing. And it's not going to come from Congress, for sure. But it is happening kind of on a local level. So we've already seen changes. Many cities have banned, for example, the sale of puppies in stores because they come from puppy mills. And so that's kind of an immediate acknowledgement that, you know, these are creatures. These are sentient animals. They're not just property. There's movement afoot in judicial case law. So there have been some cases actually in custody disputes in what to do with the dog. Is it just a piece of property or does it have feelings and interests of its own? So there have been a few cases where judges have indeed granted custody hearings for dogs. And in fact, Alaska Alaska, of all states, is the first state to actually amend their animal welfare laws to essentially say that in custody disputes, the interests of the animal need to be taken into account.
I'd like to go back to that reference I made to Yuval Harari, the author of A Brief History, well, Homo Deus, A Brief History of Time. He talks about 21st century techno-humanism reaching the goal of superhumans. And you address this at the very end of your book, but it's some scary stuff. When we start genetically engineering Homo sapiens as we know them today, what do we wind up with? And where does that put the human someday? What, looking more like the dog?
Yeah, that is what I said. So I realize it's a tough sell to get people to think about animals as sentient creatures, kind of on a footing that approaches the human level. So to put it in context, you know, every sign that I'm seeing suggests that as Yuval said, you know, the human race is engineering itself into something else. You know, the CRISPR-Cas9 technology has the ability to snip out and insert genes in, you know, both in the human genome as well as other animals. I mean, you mentioned pigs. They've already been engineered to essentially remove any antigens that people would respond to in a transplant. So, you know, pig heart valves are used commonly. And so, you know, now they've just been snipped out in terms of the things that people react to. And so at a certain point, when you begin manipulating the DNA of these other animals and you make it more human, you ask the question of when does a pig not become a pig? When does it become something else? And then looking forward in terms of humans, presently, there's a moratorium on doing these sorts of things in people. But honestly, I think it's just a matter of time and money. It'll be one step from, you know, snipping out a cancer gene to improving the so-called normal DNA, and then you're down the road of kind of creating the next whatever species will follow Homo sapiens. And at that point, then the remnants of us will be, you know, something less to this future species. And so, you know, I think honestly we need to consider the treatment of all animals in terms of sentience, because honestly in the future that's what Homo sapiens is going to be.
So is Callie your dog now that you have used in these experiments?
Yep, Callie's still around. She's still kicking it.
How old is Callie, and has she changed at all, or have you changed in your relationship to her as far as this science or research is concerned?
Yeah, so Callie's, she's probably about 8 years old now, so she's slowed down a little bit. She's not a regular participant anymore. She was eager to begin with, but as we grew, as our volunteer population of MRI dogs grew, it turns out there's a lot better dogs out there than she is. So she's not a regular participant, but she helps us debug new experiments. And what I found in working with her on this project is it certainly changed my relationship to her, and possibly hers to me, in that it's not where it was more of a just like a passive relationship where, you know, she kind of cuddled in my lap and, you know, I fed her. We weren't doing much before. Now it's much more active, and I would say much more enjoyable when we do things together. Even if there's no food involved, it's just the act of being together and working on something that I think is the essence of the dog-human relationship.
Well, Dr. Burns, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Again, the name of the book is What It's Like to Be a Dog and Other Adventures in Animal Neuroscience by Gregory Burns. Thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure.
If you would like to read more about where genetic engineering could possibly take Homo sapiens, pick up a copy of Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow by Yuval Harari, who Dr. Burns just mentioned. To say that this book will get you thinking about what it means to be human is a major understatement of the book's takeaway. Some scary stuff indeed. And just to lighten it up a bit, finally, since this has been an interview about a dog and it's about books, let's not forget what the comedian Groucho Marx had to say about the subject. Outside of a dog, a book is a man's best friend. Inside of a dog, it's too dark to read. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sienna Madrid. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Gustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.